If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers, don't. Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cult, extreme belief, and manipulation from two historians who've actually experienced it. I am Lo LeBlanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth.
And guys, we changed it to manipulation. We thought it would better capture the broader scope of what we're trying to talk about here. It's not just abuse of power. It's also all forms of manipulation. So we did a little name change. A little baby name change.
I like it.
I like it too. Let us know if you approve. Rate us 5 stars. Okay. Today, our guest is Joanne Viega, survivor of the Branch Davidians and the Waco Massacre. We're going to discuss her earliest memories of living on the compound in Waco, Texas, what cult leader David Koresh was like in person, and what it was like when the siege began, and why fear wasn't the emotion she felt when she saw all the dead bodies.
She'll tell us how her mom bravely acted to protect her and get her safely out, even though it went against everything they'd been taught, the terrifying transition period afterward, and learning about the fire that killed 76 people, including her own parents, plus what her life's like now and how she's thriving despite being told by adults that she wouldn't.
This is a very emotional interview, be warned, but she's amazing and I can't wait to get into it. So we thought instead of doing cultiest thing this week, we would just kind of give a little background on the Branch Davidians, because some of you young folk might not be familiar with this at the time very significant culturally story. 1993, y'all are too young. You were born in like 2003.
Producer Steve has given us some 1993 updates.
He's obsessed with 1993.
Prince became a symbol. Snoop Dogg released his first album. Okay. So some shit was happening, but some other tragic shit was also happening.
Yeah, this was right up there with Heaven's Gate and the Manson family. This was a huge, major, major event. A lot of people died. So just to give you some context, let's start sort of at the beginning. This is by no means a thorough history of this group at all. The Branch Davidians. This is present tense.
They still exist.
They still exist. Wow. Okay, so they are an apocalyptic religious group. They were founded in 1955 by Benjamin Rodin. They were a branch off of the Seventh-day Adventists originally. Over time, the leadership changed hands. And that's something I always find really interesting, is the trajectory of a cult's leadership, because spoiler, most self-proclaimed prophets don't actually live forever, so they need to be succeeded by someone. And in this case, David Koresh, not the leader originally of this cult at all. He shows up. He was a very religious young man. He had an illegal sexual relationship with a young girl. He did poorly in school. He shows up to this existing group. And it is speculated that the woman who led it at the time, Lois Rodin, who was in her 60s, it is speculated that he began a sexual relationship with her.
And her son wanted to take over.
Yes, he was supposed to be the new prophet.
Because her husband died.
It was supposed to be George Rodin. He was going to be the next leader. David Koresh comes in, and his name was not David Koresh at the time. He changed his name. We'll just refer to him by the name we all know him as. Comes in and starts trying to take over this group. And now there's this rivalry between these two guys, which is, again, this happens in so many Mormon cults. It's so interesting to see these themes of, like, rival prophets and also polygamy and underage brides in a non-Mormon cult. I really felt like these were...
Well, I think he took it a notch above the rest and did probably one of the craziest things I've ever heard in my entire life, where he challenged the other one to a duel of resurrecting the dead. He said, whichever one of us can resurrect a dead body first will be the person who takes over this cult. So then the other guy, George, is like, great, let's do it. He gets a dead body. And then David calls the police and is like, he's defiling a dead body. And the police are like, what are you doing with this dead body? And George is like, what? No, it's, I promise. This is real.
So he's like, if you can't resurrect a body, like...
Well, yeah, he just, like, took the body thing completely away and just, like, he trolled George to make him look insane with the police. George got arrested for, like, messing around with a dead body. And David had the place to himself.
So in 1989, and this is how he actually ended up in jail for real, George Roden murdered this man, Wayman Dale Adair, with an axe blow to the skull after Adair stated his belief that he himself was the true Messiah. Totally different guy. Roden claimed the man was sent by Koresh to kill him, and Roden was then judged insane and confined to a psychiatric hospital. So basically, he's trying to pin it on Koresh, but he's the one who gets confined to a psychiatric hospital. This rivalry between these men is, like, incredibly interesting. So fast forward, now they have this group. They're living on this compound together. They moved a few times, whatever. It doesn't matter. Now it's starting to come out that they're are children who are being abused by him. His doctrine of the House of David led to, quote, marriages with both married and single women. And this is sort of, at least from my understanding, this is one of the things that kind of begins the investigation into the group in general. There are these allegations, which seem to be most likely true. And that is how we end up, 1993.
If you want to look more into it, there was also something that happened 6 months before that with Ruby Ridge, where it was kind of a similar thing, smaller in its devastation. But you can just kind of see where the world was at that time. And these two instances were what Timothy McVeigh quoted as being the reason that he and his partner did the Oklahoma City bombing.
Lots of context with this cult. Incredibly significant moment in the culture. Incredibly tragic and a total absolute
shit
fuck
show.
Yeah, on the part of the authorities. I mean, what a fucking fuck up.
Yeah.
Totally unnecessary. So anyway, that brings us to now, and that brings us to our conversation with Joanne.
Get your tissues ready. She is so wonderful.
Here we go. Welcome, Joanne Viega, to Trust Me.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I'm really excited to have you on today, and also a little bit scared that we're all going to cry because your story is, oh, it is a lot. It is wild. Start us at the beginning. So you basically grew up as a Branch Davidian when you were a young child. Do you have a sense of like how your parents came to follow David Koresh?
Well, from what I gather, my parents were living in Hawaii, and David was at a church doing his normal sermon. And my mom, I want to say that it was my mom. Again, I had to hear this secondhand from my sister because my parents are no longer around. And I want to say it was my mom who was just looking for something a little bit more in life and more purpose. And so when she found David and he was, you know, such a good speaker, she kind of just was like, this is the way we're going. Mm. We're going this way. And my dad and I had to follow. So
right.
I don't really know how it happened, but I think everyone gets to the point where in their life where you're kind of like asking yourself, like, what do I do? What's going on?
Is this all?
What's the meaning? Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And I think that's where she was. And just by chance, she met David.
Incredibly charismatic man comes along. Who's also, yeah. I was surprised to see how handsome he was. Am
very
I allowed
handsome,
to say that?
Yeah.
I feel like he's very, which helps. I really do think that that's a very important
100%.
Component for gathering followers.
Absolutely.
Right now.
What was his message? I was kind of trying to start from the beginning. So I see that it began a little bit, second coming of Christ was a lot of his predecessors. Was that his thing as well? Or did he kind of leave that be?
I want to say because I did a little bit of research on this too, and I want to say because in the beginning, his rhetoric was very, I have the answers. I can show you, you know, what your purpose in life is. And it wasn't until later that he kind of changed his verbiage and started saying like, I am the Son of God.
Mm.
Like, I am the miracle and the answer. Mm. You know, it's changed. I don't know the exact year, but you do, if you watch the progress of it, it kind of starts with like, you know, we're a family, we can all, you know, love God together. And it was very inviting. And then somewhere along the lines, you can kind of notice that he started putting himself as the Messiah.
Mm.
And, you know, when you look at it now, all these flags are very clear. But I think when you're in the middle of it, you don't really notice these small little changes that happen.
Totally. It's over time. It's a, like a long ongoing process. You know, it's like one little thing isn't going to raise that many red flags.
Of course.
And then it's just like another little thing.
Do you think he believed what he was saying, or do you think he was more conning?
That's a hard one. If I could give him the benefit of the doubt, and the only reason why I do that is because I feel I wasn't there, so I really don't know. I want to say that he did believe in the beginning that he could help a lot of people and that he could bring everyone together and under, you know, the house of God. That's just a common ground that everyone's on. And I do believe that he started off like that. But then I do believe if you watch, you can see that shift of like all these people are listening to me. I have the absolute word. I can control all these people. And then I believe it came to like an absolute con, whether it was him like 100% being like, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want, or him being like, oh, no, let's test the waters. Uh-huh. But I do think it did switch.
It is interesting. I wonder if you or me, for example, like suddenly had a bunch of people who were like, we believe everything you say, you are our prophet or whatever. Like, if that had never happened in his life, would he have just like lived a regular life? And it's almost like how, you know, if you have certain mental illness predisposals, if you do LSD, it might trigger it. It makes me wonder, like, if you have that kind of power over people, does that suddenly trigger this like sociopathic side of you, you know?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, I would definitely say yes. I think that that's something that maybe we all possess. But I think in people like David, who are just so very gifted in the gab area, where he can just whatever he says, everyone's like, oh, my God, more. Right. You know, I think in his little DNA structure, maybe it was just a little bit more.
Yeah, it was there and it was waiting, but like it like got set off.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your own memories, because this is the part I'm the most curious about. So how old were you when you first were in the Waco area?
I want to say maybe one or two.
Wow. Okay.
I was very, very young. I want to say because my sister was around when I was born. I was born in Hawaii. And then when my mom decided to move us to Texas, I don't think I was more than two.
So your first memories then are probably there.
I don't have my first starting memory is in Waco.
Wow. And what is that? What is that? Can I ask?
I have little tidbits of just being alone. I always like to describe it. I'm not sure if you guys have seen those tea bag boxes that has like the rolling hills and the woman's like picking tea. Mm-hmm. In my mind, that's all I see is just like very, very vast open fields. I was always by myself a lot when I was younger. I don't remember having many people around. Mm. I barely saw my father. I think the earliest memory I have of him was us on a motorcycle doing something we weren't supposed to be, just taking a joyride, which we weren't supposed to be doing. But that's like the first and the most vivid memory I have of my dad. And I can't say that I was more than five when that happened. Again, my timeline's a little
off. Of course. I mean, it's so early.
Yeah, I just remember being alone a lot in open fields and not really having anyone around, which does sound a little odd when I say it out loud.
What were your parents doing?
That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. I want to say at the time we were living, I'm not sure if you've seen a picture of the compound or anywhere on the property, but it's like basically this really long road. And what you guys, I think, are used to seeing is that really big white building right when you come down the road. But before that was there, if you just kept continuing down the road, we each had like houses, little houses. And ours was like the very last one on this road. I want to say they were worship, you know, everyone had worship time or, you know, what the politically correct thing to say is. But they were never around. And then I do remember they were all building the big, I don't know what else to call it, the big white building.
Right. Yeah.
And so that one, I really have no clue where any adult was when I was little. Like, it was just like, okay, hopefully a coyote doesn't eat you and then you come and eat. You know, it's like, okay.
That's so interesting. So, was that lonely or was it kind of peaceful?
I think it was really peaceful. Mm. And to me, when I think about how independent I am and how like solidarity is really a driving force for me. I think it really does stem from just having a lot of alone time, and I didn't have a lot of influence from anyone else. I just kind of wandered around, and it was very peaceful. I don't ever remember it being scary or upsetting that no one was around. I found it really peaceful.
Hmm. Yeah, as an introvert, it sounds quite heavenly.
Right? <Yeah. laughs> Living the dream.
I do. Some of my favorite memories, because I grew up on a farm for like 6 years of my early years or whatever. And some of my favorite memories are like just going off into the woods and like looking at the blackberries and talking to the cows and
turning over a rock. That was always a fun one for me. Ooh, what's under this rock?
Exactly. That's exactly what it was like.
Okay. What was your relationship with your mom like at that age? I mean, you didn't see your dad that much. Did you see your mom a little bit more than him?
Yeah, and I want to say my memories were of my mom at a younger age was a little bit, well, I mean, since my dad wasn't around, she was the one that was always disciplining and, I don't have like anything super scarring, but I definitely have a feeling of like my mom was it's like having a single mom. She has to be the mom, the dad, the babysitter, the everything. And it wasn't always just fun and games.
Right. Did you have many interactions directly with David Koresh?
I did not, because I was not his child. He was definitely more involved. And I felt like it was a little bit more segregated because his children obviously were the Son of the Messiah. So they were, you know, very high end. And the rest were not. So I don't have any really big interactions with him. But I do know that all of the ones I do have are quite scary. So I try to kind of keep those on the down low.
Ooh. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah. I remember sneaking out. My mom was in a exercise class. We were upstairs somewhere in the big white building. And I remember I wasn't supposed to be there, but I was looking for my mom, and I kind of came in and I sat down right behind her. She, like, everyone was facing the front of the room, and I had sat down behind her, and I was just, you know, kind of playing around, and she didn't really mind. And then David walked in, and I just remember having like the fear of God put in me, because it was like, I know I wasn't supposed to be there. I was probably supposed to be at some worship time or whatever. And I was just stuck. And I remember my mom kind of putting her hands behind her to kind of like silence me and be like, okay, you need to stay still. And I just remember just like fearing for my life, because that was after the time where really any adult could spank any child. Yeah. They let any adults, you know, 'cause I think the thought process was, when the end of the world came and when these bad people came to kill us, that any adult was supposed to be able to have complete control over this child, to direct them or to, you know, do whatever it is that we needed to do in that moment. So all the children were conditioned to listen to any adult at the snap of a finger. And we all knew that if we didn't, it was like severe spanking. And so you feared basically every adult you came across, because if you did one thing wrong, that's like any adult could be looking at you, and that's a spanking. That's just that was it.
Well, I can imagine all of that solitude was peaceful then. No one who's going to spank me.
I remember getting spanked once by my mom's friend on our way home from school. It was so traumatizing.
Your like, mom's friend?
Yeah, we were like carpooling with this little girl my same age, and this little girl and I like got, she kept telling me she was going to a museum, and I kept going, I know, I've been there, because I was like 3 years old, and she would be like, it has this there, and I was like, I know, I've been there, and her mom just turned around and spanked the absolute shit out of me, and it was so traumatizing. So were you being spanked by other people like on the regular? What?
On the regular. It was, you know, we had in the big white building. Sorry if I'm being repetitive. had the women were on the top floor, and my bedroom that we shared with, it was me, my mom on one side on a bunk bed, and we were living with another woman on the other side. She had the other bed. Every night they would go down and do a worship group for hours and hours. So just the kids were stuck upstairs. And I remember we'd kind of like poke her head out of the rooms and kind of be like, "Hey, are you up?" And, you know, the kid across the hall would be like, "Yeah, I'm up." And we just, you know, chit chat with each other, you know, because we had no adults around. And I remember my, the lady that was living with us had come upstairs to, I don't know what she was doing, but she'd come upstairs and she saw all of us kind of talking to each other and poking our heads out. And she immediately came into, she lived in our room, came to me and just spanked the shit out of me. Oh, it was like, you know, man, you're not supposed to be out of bed. You know, you're not supposed to be talking. And after that, it was like, no more talking groups for us. We were just scared.
Oh, so sad. Yeah. And it sounds so fun too. That sounds so fun to be able to plug like, your head out and say, "Are you up?" Wow. Cool. Thanks for taking that away.
I know. In terms of what the group believed, what was your conception of that?
Well, I think when every adult tells you the same story as a child, you kind of have no choice but to believe it.
Yeah.
And all we knew is we were preparing for this big war. We were God's chosen people because we chose to believe David Koresh and we chose to follow him, that we would be saved. Everyone else was going to die. We were going to be saved and we were going to go to heaven and our family would be together. And, you know, it was, I did have my sister in my life. It was very minimal. She would call every once in a while. I remember talking to her on the phone, but I also remember thinking like, okay, well, if we all die, like we go to heaven, she's not coming with us. Like that's going to suck. Mm. You know, like you kind of start to put these things together. It doesn't really make complete sense because an adult's telling you like without a doubt, like, okay, well, when we're all going to die, you know, you'll be saved. So it doesn't matter. Just you'll be with your parents and because we all chose to believe David. So you grow up with that mentality. And that's why when we were attacked by the ATF, I didn't think it was abnormal. I didn't think, because you have everyone telling you, you know, these bad people are going to come and they're going to kill you. And so we actually, you know, even more to back up David, we're like, hey, what he said was true. This is it. Like, this is what we've been waiting for. So for me, I just thought it was another day. I'm like, hey, this is how it goes.
Where was your sister? How much older was she? Is she?
She's 18 years older than me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she chose to stay in Hawaii. She wanted nothing to do with David. She wanted nothing to do with my parents' involvement in the Branch Davidian group, which good for her. You know, I think at 25, I don't even remember like what my core beliefs were at 25, but for her to be like, I'm not doing that, I think takes a big amount of guts.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So you guys would talk regularly and you have this like connection with someone.
Yeah, she would send me books and little art, those little plastic things that you open and it has like all the little art supplies in it and stuff like that. So
cute.
I remember her being there. Of course, I had no idea what she looked like. I had no idea where she was. I just remember talking to her briefly every once in a while and knowing that she was there.
I guess just one more question about David, which is just like, did you get like a sense of magic around him? Like, did he feel like a prophet or was he just kind of a scary adult?
He was like the most scary adult. Mm. He, like, there's nothing about him that made you feel comfortable. I want to even say, if I can even reach this far, I want to even say as an adult looking at David, I think everyone was kind of scared out of their pants because he has this, I mean, when we're all together, I'm sure in the beginning it didn't seem so out of place or that he was this fearful figure. But toward the end, just any time you looked at him, he just was like, you just wanted to die. Like, you just want to like shrivel down and be like, I'm so sorry. Like, I don't know what it was. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting.
But he was like the scariest person I have probably ever met in my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
They always devolve, right? And get so paranoid and like agitated.
Yeah.
So this is all happening in the early 90s, right? So in 1993, there was an article published saying that he was a polygamist who was taking underage brides. Mm-hmm. Was that true? Do you know?
We heard little rumors, you know, as kids, because I think we all knew as kids that that's what was going on. And we had heard rumors that there was a specific girl. She had long blonde hair. I don't know who exactly she was, and I definitely don't want to put a name out there because I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But we all knew, like, and she was probably 14. We all knew that she was going to be David's next wife. We, as kids, we all kind of were like, that's the one. That's the one.
Oh.
I don't know. And of course, you know, we hear kids absorb everything from their surroundings. So I'm not sure who would have started that. But that was like common knowledge for all the kids to kind of know that he was taking other wives. And I don't know how many there were. I don't know any of that stuff. But
Was the brainwashing so intense that it's like, ah, lucky, like, you're the prophet's wife? Or are you still a little kid who's like, ew, no, please not me?
I was a little kid, and I just wanted to make sure that would never be me.
Right.
And I did kind of figure if you, like, if we're stating the obvious that David had a type.
Right.
I'm Asian, so I'm like, woohoo. I'm never going to be in that lane. So, all right. You know, but he definitely had a type. And I think all of us were like, okay, we've all checked that box. We're not going in that direction. So it's okay.
Wow. So that article comes out, and it seems to be, I mean, obviously there's so many factors that sort of lead to the siege, but it seems like that is sort of one of the initial
red flags for people.
Or... Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm curious, were you guys aware of that in the group? Did the paranoia begin because of that, or is just an unrelated detail?
I think that me being that young, I want to say it wasn't really on our forefront of things that we understood really or kept tabs on. I know that my mom had reached out to my sister a couple times and was asking to leave, and she wanted to,
really?
She wanted to get out of there. Yeah. And I don't know what caused that, because she was so very adamant that David was the answer. So for her to make that kind of switch where she was like, I can't do this, I'm out. Something significant, I think, had to trigger her morals for her to be like, that's not right.
Right.
And it just didn't happen. David would not let her go. No one was allowed to leave. And I think my sister told me she tried to escape once, but she couldn't take me, so she came back.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Come on.
Oh.
No.
Okay. So let's get into the siege a little bit, because you directly experienced the beginning of this horrible thing. And I mean, I guess you sort of said it when it first happened, it wasn't surprising, because he'd been talking about how the end of the world was coming.
Yeah, you're like, oh, okay, it's starting. It's happening. Cool.
Yeah.
But so there are gunshots. Like, what did it actually look like?
So because our bedroom was on the second floor, and I could look down to the front from our room. I could look down to the front of the door of the building. And then you can also see the driveway. I just remember it being one of those mornings. Didn't seem like much. My mom came in, told me to get dressed. I was in pajamas, and she said, you know, get dressed, we're gonna go and eat. And of course, like a little kid, I did not listen, and I definitely took my time. I want to say I was like maybe halfway out of pajamas when this started. And I looked out the window, and all you see is just little black dots coming down the road. And I just kind of looked at it, and it just, from there, was just like a hail of gunfire. It just was like these loud blasts all over, all crazy. And my mom ran in. She was downstairs. She ran in, grabbed me off the bunk bed, put me on the floor. She laid on top of me, and she just said, you know, you have to be quiet. And it was just like all hell. And that memory stops right then. So that was days and hours of gunfire. So I don't know exactly when that ended. And I just remember thinking, well, this is it. You know, this is where we die.
So you're expecting to die and then go right to heaven or whatever.
Yeah. That was the deal. That's what every adult had told you, and you believed it. You had nothing else to go by. And when it comes, you know, semi-true, like, you feel like, well, this is exactly what everyone had said was going to happen, and here we are.
So I believed in a prophet when I was a kid, not for as long, and, you know, it didn't end as tragically, although there were some bad things that happened. But I remember that feeling of, like, oh, yeah, like, the end is coming, and, like, then we're going to be part of the final battle or whatever, and we'll be immediately brought to heaven. This is exciting. He was never that explicit in, like, what that would actually look like, but I'd been taught in just regular Mormonism my whole life up to that point that, like, the second coming was coming and, like, shit was going to go down and we would all be chosen or whatever. So I think, like, on some level, if that had happened to me, I would have been, like, a little bit excited. Like, it's here. We're doing it. We're the chosen people. God's picked the time. Like, hell yeah, you know.
I don't remember being scared at all. Like, wow. There was not one part of me that was like, this doesn't feel right, or should this really be happening? Like, it was like, all right, well, here we are. Here we go.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah.
So 6 Branch Davidians died in that first round of gunfire, and then and 4 government agents, I think. Did you see them?
Again, my timeline during that also probably has skipped around a little bit. I do remember walking through our hallway because they had first moved all the children and the women who were at the front part of the building. There was, like, all rooms, a hallway, and then another set of rooms. They had moved us to the back end of the building and put the kids under the bunk beds. In order to get out of that, you had to go down the hall to go downstairs to, like, where the cafeteria was, where the church was, where the front door was, and there was no other exit. It was just the one way down the hall. And I do remember walking to get downstairs and seeing a bunch of bodies kind of lying on the floor. And to me, and every, you know, you can see, and this was at night when we had no electricity, and there was just the searchlights that they put on, the really bright searchlights on the building. And from that, you can see all the gun holes in the walls as you walk down the hall. And it really is one of those scary movies where you just, it's pitch black. The only light you have is coming from outside, and it's just all gun holes everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very serene. It was not fearful. I wasn't like, holy crap, what has just happened? It was more like, all right, okay. Just waiting for the axe to drop, I guess.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so as somebody who's also told the end of time is about to come at all moments of my life, I think I would have been much more terrified than both of you. I think I would have totally flipped out. But there is that feeling of, like, at least it's finally happening and about to be over. Like, the axe has fallen. I can really relate to, you know?
Yeah. I think you kind of just wander around being like, so...
when? Tomorrow?
Why am I still alive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what's happening?
Yeah.
They didn't tell you this.
Right. Wow. But it is just so crazy that they just show up and start fucking shooting at people. Mm-hmm.
There's kids in there.
There's kids in there. They had a warrant for David's arrest, and they had a search warrant. How the fuck does that turn into, like, spraying bullets to the point where the walls are covered in bullets? Like, that is insane.
How many kids were in there?
I don't, 27, I think, 23.
That is wild.
I mean, you know, the Branch Davidians are shooting back, right? It's an exchange of gunfire, but it's like, why did it even have to begin this way?
Yeah.
How many days were you there? If you know.
I don't have an exact date. And of course, remember, we also were not schooled. So for me, like, we had no idea what days were, what dates were, what months were, what time was.
Really?
We had no clue.
Wow.
They did not school us at all. The only thing we were schooled in was just Bible knowledge.
Mm. So did that involve reading? Would they teach you to read the Bible?
They would, like, highlight, they would say, here's a passage. You want to look at this and highlight every time you see the word God. And that's the only word you really need.
Wow.
It had nothing to do with what was happening. I could not read. As soon as I got out, it was just like you start from -5, not even ground zero.
I am so impressed with you. Just
yeah.
No words. Wow.
You're obviously incredibly intelligent and made up for that lack of education in your childhood, but that is that's insane. So some amount of time you were there.
Yeah, I want to say it was, if I can kind of take a stab, I want to say it's like a week to 2 weeks. I remember it being, because in my mind, I think I only have maybe 5 memories of that whole time. That's why when I don't know who said, they're like, oh, you were in there for like a week or 2 weeks. I was like, but how is that possible? Because I only have like 5 memories of that. So I don't know where that time went. I'm sure somewhere in my psyche, you know, they kind of shut everything down and was like, right. Hey, this is not appropriate for a 6-year-old to be going through. So right. We're just going to shut all that down. And I haven't got any of it back, so I really don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very specific logistical question, but like, while there's all of this gunfire being exchanged, what are you doing for meals? Like, how are you just like getting through the days?
So David had stockpiled MRE, those military meals.
Oh.
I remember having, like, seeing in the cafeteria just a wall of just boxes of food. And it was, again, just preparation for the end of time. So in that regard, he was prepared.
Right. And that you had them in your house? Like, are you all
confined? Yeah, you just went downstairs and grabbed a box or whatever and...
Oh, because you guys are all living in the big white building at this point.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And there were other children obviously experiencing this with you.
Yeah. I didn't see any of them. I'm not sure where everyone kind of dispersed to. I just know that when I was moved from my bedroom to the back part of the upstairs, I was with one other girl and we were just underneath the bed. They had put like pillows and everything, like as if a pillow is going to help. But they had put pillows all the way around underneath the bed for us, and they just kind of shoved us in there. And so you're just waiting in the dark, listening to the chaos happening.
Oh my gosh!
Did they do different things with his children? Do you remember what happened to them?
So David had a separate wing of the building, so. When you go through the front door, you can take a left and you can go upstairs for all the women and children where we were. Downstairs was the men. If you went straight back, it was the church. And then behind the church, above, like you kind of went behind it and went up the stairs, theirs was his apartment.
I see.
So that's where he lived. And I want to say he lived with his wife. I don't know which one, but that was his place. So I want to say all the kids were his children were with him.
Hmm. Okay. So tell us about how your mom makes a move to protect you at this point.
So from what I can gather, she already knew that this was not right, her trying to escape, her trying to leave. So I think in the moment when she realized that kids were being released, she really advocated, like, you know, she's not your daughter. She has nothing to do with you. She's not the chosen one. Let her go. And she came back. I just remember her saying, you know, hold on 1 second. I'm going to go talk to David. And she came back and she said, you're getting out of here. And she, like, as fast as you possibly can. Sorry, that was...
You're good. You're good.
As fast as any person possibly can, you know, gather as many things that you have to put on your child. And she just, as fast as she could, grabbed my arm, took me downstairs and was like, you're going, like, that's it. There's no questions. There was nothing that she was so very confident in that decision. And I think that her as a mom, her instincts, everything about her as being a mom just kind of kicked in all at once right then and there. Wow. Because she also understood that by releasing me, she would never be able to go.
Hmm.
So that, I think, is like the biggest sacrifice as a parent that you can make and like really, you know, be in that moment to like make that decision. There was no second questioning. She was so dead set.
Mm.
Sorry. Oh my gosh.
No, you are totally fine. We're
in the same boat as you. Yeah. So why does her making the decision for you to go mean she can never go? Because she has no leverage anymore of like how to get out or.
Well, there was only talk of releasing children.
I see.
I'm not sure if there was ever a conversation of releasing adults.
Mm.
And I think when she put everything together, she realized it probably was never really about an adult leaving. It was like, get the kids out. If you are a mom and you really have come to the realization that this is not the Messiah, he is not the person that he said he was going to be, and he was not going to be able to deliver all these promises that he said he was, you know, your reality kind of sinks in. And she just was like, take her, just get her out. And she was, both my parents were extremely strong because when I was leaving, I got to say goodbye to both my parents. And I don't remember either of them crying because, I mean, if you think about it, if you had told me that we were supposed to die and we would all be together and then all of a sudden plans change, I'm handing you over to these bad people.
Exactly.
Who I told you for the first 6 years of your life that they were going to kill you and that they were bad and you don't ever talk to them. If you see them, you run, you tell an adult.
Yeah.
And now I'm handing you to these people and I am not going to be with you. Like, it's such a different mental state to be in, and just you have to go with it. And as a kid, you know, we were taught to listen to adults, just that's the only thing. So I didn't question it. I didn't understand really fully what it meant at the time, but I just knew that my parents said you have to go. They were not upset, they weren't crying, they weren't like in fear. It was just a very calm like, you have to go. And she put her necklace and a note for my sister in my pocket, in my jacket. And she just sent me out the door. And that was, that was it.
That is,
I just, I am marveling at the strength that it would take to do that when they were so indoctrinated into this idea that these deaths would be a good thing. These would mean you would be together. You know, you'd been waiting for this. And I just like that leap that it takes to be like, I'm actually going to defy everything I've believed for the past however many years to save my daughter. Yeah. Like,
and
yeah.
She did an interview. I remember seeing her. She's in a truck and she was asked if she believed that David Koresh was Son of God, and her response was, I hope so. And that to me was like, if there was ever a time to know that she did not believe that was true, that was it. Because it came from her own words. She had every choice to say 100% we're here, we 100% believe this. And her choice of word was, I hope so.
Thank God she was doubting. I mean, thank God that's why you're here. Like, that's
I just can't. The unwinding that she did and how quickly and how, like, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, my mom works with a lot of people who are exiting the group that they're in, and like it's a long process. Like that. Like, so anyway, it's just an amazing decision. Yeah.
I'm very thankful.
And so you left, and then what, they just like take you, and was it scary?
It was scary. When I'm going to say this out loud, it doesn't sound scary, but in my mind, when you have no experience whatsoever, like a flushing toilet scared the shit out of me.
Wow.
Taking a bath, like a bubble bath, scared the absolute crap out of me.
You guys didn't have running water? at all? No running water, no electricity?
No.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
It was, I want to say we had electricity, but I don't think we had running water.
Okay.
Because we did not have toilets or baths. For baths, we had a big tin bath, and then we had to fill it up with water and then take it out.
Wow.
So it was not, it was nothing. It wasn't like the luxuries of having a flushing toilet now. So for me, when I thought it was definitely a trick, and I thought I was going to get spanked, you know, every time I was supposed to flush the toilet or take a bath, I definitely thought like, holy shit, like I'm going to get spanked. This is not normal. This is not how we do things. And it took a lot of unwinding for me to start over and to start from scratch for the basic things that, you know, everyone has now. We had never watched movies. So for me, I think the first movie we saw was The Little Mermaid. They took us to a home. I don't know if you call it a shelter or a home where all the kids were staying. And they let us watch movies. They let us, you know, play sports, have candy, have soda. It was just one of those things where you think, I'm definitely going to get spanked if I take a sip of this. And a lot of the videos that I have seen I was always in the background by myself, kind of just like, this is not right. I definitely feel like I'm going to get spanked or punished, or this is just not right. I was it's hard to watch those videos and see just how mentally insecure I was in like the basic things.
Well, it makes total sense. It's the only thing you'd ever known. Like,
yeah,
this is goes against everything you've ever been taught with a bunch of strangers. Like, why would you be immediately on board?
Not only strangers, but like the enemy.
The enemy.
The enemy.
Yeah.
And I mean, The Little Mermaid. Wow. Imagine never seeing a movie and then you're just watching.
Did you like
Ursula?
It?
Was it amazing? Was it terrifying?
Yeah.
The first one, I think we watched it and all of us were like, what the hell just happened? And then we were like, can we repeat that? And so we just had it like nonstop, the same movie over and over.
Wow.
And for me, my sister's name is Ursula and my middle name is Ursula. So for me, I was like, holy cow, who is this? And of course, I ended up the villain, but, you know, that's all right.
Kind of cool, actually. Yeah. Ursula's her own person, doing some cool shit. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Ursula's super cool.
I like her.
Stealing voices from ladies. And how long was it before you were living with your sister?
I don't think it was more than a couple weeks, maybe. Again, timelines are not great with me.
Yeah.
She had to go through a lot of fighting in court. And I think what had ultimately became the deciding factor was the note that my mom had left in my jacket was basically saying that my sister was now my guardian. That's who she wanted me to go with. Mm. Right. And so she's writing this note in the middle of all that chaos, knowing that an outcome needed to happen. And that's what she wrote. Like, your sister is now your guardian. That's who I'm trusting.
That's incredible foresight. Again,
like, right.
Very impressive.
So,
wow.
So then I moved to Hawaii, and that, again, you want to talk about scary times, is like going to school for the first time. And, you know, children are relentless in their beliefs as a child, because you're so solely believing one thing. You don't know how to think for yourself, really. And going to school, I remember being teased for not having parents, for not having my parents around. And it was really rough. Wow. It was definitely rough.
Did you feel a connection with your sister? I mean, you'd never met, but you'd talked enough.
Yeah, it was immediate. And I had no idea who, you know, what she looked like. I had no idea. I was just brought to an office and she was sitting in there with a social worker or someone. And I just remember, like, as soon as I locked eyes with her, I was like, that's my sister. And I just crawled into her lap and she was my safe zone. And she's been my safe zone for a very long time.
Wow. So the Waco siege lasted for 51 days. which is absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. How did you get the news about the fire?
My sister every morning would turn on the TV before I'd go to school and watch the news. And that morning she turned it on and it was just, everything was up in flames. And she just immediately, she was so quick, turned off the TV. I don't even think I had a chance to see what was on the TV. She turned it off. She said, all right, let's get you to school. And as if nothing had happened, and I went to school, had no idea what was happening. And she said she just pulled over and cried. And I think it's hard for me to think about this because not only did I go through this experience, but she did too. She was, I don't want to say burdened, but she definitely had a lot of things she had to deal with that she did not sign up for.
Yeah.
So she was definitely a rock. And then she picked me up from school, said, you know, we need to talk. And, you know, mom unfortunately has died. And my response to her just was like, yeah, I know. Like, you guys told me that this was going to happen. Like, I wasn't surprised. I was, again, very calm, very just a matter of fact. Like, that was a fact. Yes.
Wow.
And she, I think that might have scared her a little bit, if I can be honest. But yeah, and then from then, I think every adult in my life has tried to be a little bit more kind to, I think they all waited for the axe to drop as if I were going to lose it or like I was not expecting this, that your parent unfortunately passed and, you know, it would all hit me at one time and it didn't. It just was like very, like even to this day, I don't ever really cry when I hear that back because it was so, it was just a fact to me. Like, okay. So,
wow.
Yeah.
76 people died that day, including 20-something children.
That is so crazy. That is just so crazy, dude.
Yeah. When you think about your mom now, what do you think? Like, what do you hold on to?
I think of her and I think, yeah, she made this decision to be part of a group that she thought was going to give her the answer she was looking for in her life. And I think everyone kind of gets to that cross point where you figure what's going on with, you know, my life, what am I doing? And it doesn't really matter to me how she got there. It doesn't matter where she was in her own growth journey or not even growth journey, whatever. It doesn't matter because when the time came for her to make the most crucial decision, she didn't question. She just, I think in her every moral fiber of her being, she knew what was right.
Yep.
And she made, you know, just the most difficult decision that any parent can make. And that's what defines her in the end. Like, it has nothing to do with how she got here.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with her battles that she fought while she was there or any of it. It doesn't matter to me. It matters to me that she found herself. She found what she knew was right and she went with it.
Yeah.
Oh, she's a hero.
Yeah. She protected you when it was the most important, and that's the important thing to remember, it seems like. What's your life like now?
I have three beautiful boys. My husband and I work in our family restaurant in San Francisco. I am right now the pastry chef there. And my eldest son, Logan, who's 16, he has definitely been my rock during a lot of growing through being a parent. He comes to work with me every 3 days a week. He works with me. I'm just trying very hard to raise kind, gentle men for this world because I feel like that's definitely what is needed right now. So I have a 4-month boy. When we found out we were pregnant, I was so sure. I said, you know what? I'm ready. if now is ever the time I'm ready to raise a strong woman. If that's my lot in life, I can do it. I have the energy. I have the patience. I would love to raise a strong woman. That was not the choice that was made. And a good friend of mine, because she knew how disappointed I was, because I was so very set. I said, this world needs a strong woman. I'm ready to do that. And now what am I going to do? I have another boy. And she gently reminded me, she said, you know, I think the world does have enough strong women in it right now. I think what we are lacking is just kind men.
Good men.
So yeah. If that's the journey you're supposed to be on and you have three opportunities to do that, I think that's where you should be. And I just kind of was like, oh, holy shit, you're right. Damn it. Mm-hmm. So I gave up the idea of raising a strong woman, and I am trying to raise kind and gentle men who, you know, have a little bit of a backbone, but still can contribute kindness, because I think we definitely need that now.
I love that perspective so much. I think that that is an excellent point that your friend made, because
mm-hmm. right
there, mm-hmm. most of the problems in this world are men who are afraid to be soft or vulnerable, or I should say are have root causes in dynamics mm-hmm. involving men. You know, I don't want to say it's men's fault, but you know what I mean. So yeah, I think that's incredibly important. And just based on this conversation, I would guess you're doing an excellent job of doing that.
Oh, thank you. I really do try. It's hard work every day.
I read something that I'm not sure is true. It was like an article, but it said that a social worker or somebody when you first got out was telling you, like, you're not going to be a good person. Is that?
Yeah.
I mean,
they told my sister to basically make sure I continue therapy, because the chances that I would grow up to be a Unabomber was very likely.
Oh my God.
Or, you know, a mass murderer was basically what everyone thought I would be.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm not sure where that study
that's some
came
flawed
into play.
Psychology.
Yeah, wow. I was hoping you'd be like, no, that's not real. Okay, that was real. So you've just shown up in everyone's faces and have a beautiful life. And yeah.
Well, I think when you hear that, you know, at a young age, you kind of think like, I really would like that to not be true. Mm. And your decision making from then kind of veers you the opposite.
Right.
As I don't really know how I got to this point, if I can be honest, but it's just a day in and day out small decisions that are made to make sure that I do not kill a bunch of people.
It sounds like, though, that you had this wonderful sister who really, like, guided you through what could have been a really, which probably was a very rocky, tumultuous time. But having that person can make all the difference in the world, too. Not that you would have ever been a mass murderer. That's not a thing.
So absurd. I just mean in terms of
like turning out relatively healthy and balanced and well adjusted, all things considered.
Yeah, we had some growing pains. I'm not going to say that it was, you know, rainbows and sunshine. We definitely went through a lot of growing pains, and we had a lot of discovering and growth to do between the two of us to kind of navigate and make sure both of us got out of this alive, so to speak. And you just need one person. You need a village when it comes to raising children. I think that's a thing, because raising a child on your own is freaking crazy. So yeah. To single moms who do it, holy freaking cow, I salute you. But I do think that it just, if you have one person in your life who tells you and means it when they say, like, you're enough, that's it. It's just one. You just need one.
Yeah.
You don't need every single person that you come across to tell you that. You just need one that you trust. And that's it. You're enough.
Yeah.
Every day, you're enough.
Mm-hmm. I imagine your story will be very inspiring to our listeners, because we have a fair amount of listeners who had their own either cultic or abusive or just like general traumatic experiences. And it's so inspiring to see when someone comes out of something that's so extreme and so difficult and just like
flourishes,
thrives anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do want to just say, because I've been asked a lot, I have kids in high school who reach out and ask me to answer their questions for a school project that they do. And I've been noticing lately that it has been a majority of people who write to me that are in high school who say, you know, we're learning about this in history class, and I was just hoping you'd be able to answer some questions and talk to me. And as I get older and I realize that this isn't something that everyone has grown up with on the news, there are obviously very different problems happening today. I think my main goal to tell these kids, and I tell each one of them, like, you're enough. Like, I just want you to know that in school, because people don't tell you in high school, they don't tell you in middle school or elementary school. We weren't raised with parents who nurture us in a way where it's always a comfortable growth. I think our generation before us has been very rough. Mm-hmm. So I do want to make it a thing where I tell these kids before you get to being an adult and have to figure it out on your own, and no one's ever told you that you were enough, that you're enough. That's really just that's my whole spiel. I just want to make sure that kids hear it from someone that they're enough, because I never heard it. So
yeah, you don't have to be like that influencer on Instagram or wearing, having that particular body or whatever it is there. I can't imagine being, we were just talking about this, but I cannot imagine being a kid right now. It's very, very hard. So, yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is truly an amazing conversation, and you just seem like such an awesome person. And really appreciate it.
We really do.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right, Megan, time for the question. Would you join this cult?
To be fair, living on a compound sounds pretty fun. As you've mentioned, he's very good looking. I don't necessarily agree, but if I found him good looking, it might be influential. Yeah, I could see myself hanging out down in the big white building for a minute.
Down in the big white building. Mm-hmm. That's a song title for sure.
Yep.
Yeah, I think the religious element would maybe make it not one of mine.
Oh, yeah, the religious element is not fun.
Yeah. But commune living, like, sure. Actually, the parts where she's describing just, like, being on her own in this, like, beautiful, natural setting, I'm like, that sounds great. I would do that for sure. And, like, the sleepover vibes with the kids, but then other, you know, minus the punishing adults. Who knows, you know? It was a really particular time, a really particular religion, but
I can see why people got sucked in.
Me too.
Thank you guys for spending another week listening to us. We can't wait to see you here again next week. Remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never, ever
trust me.
Bye.
Later. Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.